Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hello and welcome to Pro U Podcast, episode number 102. Jonah Ray is not on this podcast, but Jonah Ray is the best Pro U Podcast guest getterer there's ever been. And he got this guest, Ed Salazar, a wonderful gentleman, a beautiful human being, and prior to chatting with him, Jonah told me how wonderful he was, and then I trained one of my clients, Ernie, who's been on the podcast, and mentioned to her, and she told me how wonderful he was, so I was very excited, and I'm just thankful that, you know, cool people are willing to come on the podcast and share their stories. It's humbling every time. And what I loved about Ed is, you know, here is a man that has searched, as I have searched, for a better him, one that feels a little better, one that connects, one that feels a little bit more comfortable, a bunch of similarities in our stories. But how he explains, you know, certain things, it was very unique. And I really loved some of the ways he, you know, his perspective. And I enjoyed it. And before I knew it, we had, you know, gone an hour and a half. So a big shout out to Jonah Ray. Thank you, thank you. Love you. And just a big thank you to Ed for his time and his energy and his openness to share. Like, I'm just like, wow, thank you. Like, I'm not paying you. I wish I was for you to come in and, you know, come to my place and open up and share. So hopefully affecting listeners, you know, people just give that time. And that's never anything that I take lightly. So thank you, thank you, thank you, Ed. And thank you guys for being here and listening. And without further ado, here he is. Enjoy.
Really great marketing. Is he a mixer?
Yeah, he's a pit bull. A brindle pit bull mix. And right when I got him, I was like, you know, walking him, and people with boxer knowledge are like, he's mixed with a boxer. And I'm like, okay, I got you, I got you. So yeah, that's him. But people compliment me a lot. They walk, you know, like, oh, I love your dog, oh, my dog. And I'm like, I cannot take any credit for that, but but thank you. And this is Ed Salazar, who just met Zen.
This is Ed Salazar, and this is the sound of my voice, and I am petting Zen the dog, which is unironically very relaxing. This is the most lovable dog. We barely got up the stairs because all he wants is affection the whole time.
It's funny because I notice that when I walk up the steps, he'll run with me.
Yeah.
But if someone's like here, they're walking behind me, he walks with that person. And it's like, you can't teach a dog that. He's like that loving. And then he gets up and he's like, okay, they're going to talk now. I'm going to take a nap.
And he welcomes you to the pack and then kind of.
Yeah. I've had him 7 months. There's no way that I could even if I was the dog whisperer, I don't think I could teach a dog all his traits. He's amazing. Okay. So I had two clients this morning before I have you on the podcast. Ernie Walker, Jonah Ray. Do you know either one?
I love Ernie and I love Jonah. Yeah. I know. I've known Ernie from Channel 101, and she's one of the most amazing people. Loves Dio. It was like the first thing I met her. I was like,
that's hilarious.
She loves Ronnie James Dio, like unironically, 100%.
She has a tattoo.
Yeah. She does have a tattoo. She also does night workout, that rave workout thing.
You know, what's so funny is she just got back from Japan, so she was gone. She came this morning, we were like training and talking a mile a minute, and I forgot to bring it up because while she was away, her picture got posted in that some newspaper advertising for this woman.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so Ernie. I mean, ever since I met Ernie, there were two things. You know, her name, well, more than two. Her name, number one, her socks never matched. And there was something always neon on her.
Right.
I'm like, you're like total like 80s. She's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, so it's like seeing her in this class in LA at her age, I go, this is perfect.
I'm in when probably 6 years ago, there was a Channel 101 show. And I know, because I listened to the Derek Mears episode, so I know you've talked about Channel 101. Channel 101 is great. If you want to look at some shorts, kind of like Funny or Die sort of shorts things, but they're like mini TV shows. And one of them is like about dance fighting, and that's how I met her. And yeah, it was like she wanted to dance and wear neon with all
of her
friends.
You mean like battle? Yeah, it was like a breakdance battle?
Yeah, yeah, it was like a whole show about dance fighting. And Johnny Pepperton is in it, who's now on Son of Zorn. I think Matt Peters is in it, maybe, who's
really?
On Orange is New. Yeah, it's, I mean, if you go back and watch old Channel 101, it's like every once in a while you'll see someone like, oh, that guy is there. That's something else.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's the best in, it's one of the best environments in LA, honestly. So
yeah, I've gone to it a couple times, and I mean, I like everything about it, but it's now doing the podcast, you know, you have a guest and they refer somebody and they know somebody that knows somebody. And the number of times that 101 has been mentioned, and then it's the cool way it's been talked about. It's like, okay, here's all the bad things about LA, except for Channel 101. Here's all the things you can't find anywhere else. Like, because again, it's people bonding and just going, let's have fun, let's play, let's get along, let's be cool, let's be friendly. And that's unique.
Yeah, I had a friend who was visiting. And I wanted to take her to something that normal tourists wouldn't come to LA and see. And
oh, I love that.
And something that I thought showed like LA in a positive light. So I took her to a Channel 101 screening. And Steve, Hollywood Steve, who's one of like the legacy.
That's a great name. That's a great name. Hollywood Steve.
He's one of the legacy members. If you've ever seen Yacht Rock, which is kind of one of the more famous ones, he's the guy who kind of is supposed to be the host of Yacht Rock. And he made this video, and it wasn't a bad video, but it was low budget. It was basically only him, and I think it was like something about Hitler and Jesus wrestling, and he got the least amount of votes, and then
that's a great name as well.
I think he maybe got 5 or 10 votes or something like that. But then they brought him up at the end. And everyone cheered him, and he gave like a little speech saying like, we have to remember, because people are getting so good at making videos now, and I think this, like, going back to training and going back to working out and everything in life, is like people are so good at things now that you can look up and be like, well, I want to make a video, and you look up at like what people are doing in videos. If I'm not as talented as my friends who are in Fatal Farm, like these guys do amazing special effects, do After Effects, they do green screen. It's like, well, I can't do that, so I shouldn't make anything. Or you know, and you say, well, I want to exercise, and then you go and you buy a muscle magazine, and you see those guys, you're like, well, I'm not going to be those
them.
Guys. Yeah. So why even try?
Why start if I can't be the best?
And so Steve Huey got up and gave a speech, basically like, we don't forget like to make stuff even if it's not going to be good. And everyone applauded, my friend. So that was she's like, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And it's the special thing that's about Channel 101. It's
wow.
Like, no one is judged for making things. It may not get in and it may not win, but everyone
gets... The crazy thing is you begin like wanting as a child or a youth, like kind of creating. And you go, oh, I like this. Oh, hey, someone notices I'm good at it.
Yeah.
Someone says, oh, come here and do it. And then it changes.
Right.
Oh, well, now... There, I liked how that felt. I want affirmation. I need affirmation. Okay, I didn't get affirmation, but Billy got affirmation. And then I was like, oh, wow. When did that change?
Right, yeah. You lose the process. And
well, staying focused on what's really important is hard when all those external factors come into play.
Because,
again, that's the hardest thing. I mean, to balance, if I said, Ed, I want you to stand up right now. Mm-hmm. And you did. And they said, okay, Ed, balance on one foot. And you did. I'm like, wow, that's great. Okay, now we're going to go up 1,000 feet in the air, and I'm going to put you on a 4-inch beam. And I'm going to go, okay, Ed, stand on one foot. That little thing just became way harder because of everything else
right.
around you. And that's, again, the hardest thing. But if you were that dope at just going, dude, I'm Zen, I'm one, I'm peaceful, you could probably do it if you were that. Oh, but again, that's hard. That's really, you know, again, yeah. They say master a village is great. Master yourself. That's, you know, the challenge.
Yeah, I think the stakes shouldn't matter. The action should matter in a way, you know, like you should process everything sort of.
But see what's happened. But that's the sad thing, though, is that the world is like that. And all of us individually have to undo that so we can pursue our thing.
Right.
You know, we have to do that. You know, my little saying, I use it with Chris Hardwick, and it made his book, was that we're fountains. Mm-hmm. And our only, real responsibility is to the best of our ability, let that which lies inside of us to flow freely out and then stop.
Yeah.
But what we do is, how high? Where did it land? Was it a pretty splash? Did people see it? Were there ripples? And that's where you lose it. Because it's like I said, it's very, very hard to just go, okay, I'm just going to let whatever is inside of me come out as pure as I can.
Right.
And I'm going to do that consistently, and I guarantee you, you'll probably make money down the road doing that. But that is so hard.
Yeah.
Because vulnerability and all those other things kind of come in. Well, before we get too far.
Yeah,
ahead,
sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. No, no, no apologies. I make people apologize and do 10 push-ups, Ed, when they apologize for no reason. So we're going to implement that rule because I can tell you're an apologizer.
Wow,
Jonah,
so
ask Jonah next time you see him, hey, Jonah, what happens when you say I'm sorry and it's no, you shouldn't have? And he'll go, yeah, Tom makes me do 10 push-ups. So Jonah Ray sent you in.
Yes.
And told me wonderful things about you. And I always like that when someone I love, like a whole bunch, talks really highly of someone. I'm like, oh, I get excited to get to meet him. And then I trained him this morning. It was first time back, and he had an amazing, 2 weeks with Mystery Science 3000. And then meltdown ending, he's kind of looking at me like, he goes, I don't even know if I've processed. I go, I know you haven't processed all of this.
Right.
But then coincidentally, on Wednesday mornings, I have Ernie, and I mentioned to her that, I've known Ed, and then she said really, really wonderful things about you. So you come walking in, and I'm going, I love Ed. I already love Ed. Which, my last point, I look at Ed, I go, I know you. He's like, I go, did you do? And I'm like, I don't want to, what are you talking about? I go, hey, fish baseball. And someone go, what are you talking about? And I was like, I didn't want to say, but this is going to sound weird. But I'm like, and I go, Hidden America, yeah, I did this. And I go, fish baseball. And you go, yeah. And I'm like, we did fish baseball
together,
and Jonah didn't remember, so I'm going to give him crap about that. But that, I thought, well, I told Jonah I loved doing that because I loved
his
show Hidden America, but that was a blast.
Whoever speaks at whoever else's funeral has to bring up, I met him playing fish baseball.
Right?
Just in the middle of a eulogy, just be like, and when I saw him swing a bat at a fish, I knew that he was a very
good
man.
Would be friends for a long time. Yeah. That is so funny, though. I still not saw it because I cannot get CISO. I don't know how to
get the app downloaded.
I was trying to go through Apple TV and
there's no Apple TV, but you can get
Well, that's my problem.
Yeah, that's the problem. But you can download it just on your phone or iPad or whatever. Yeah, it's like a separate. It's like a YouTube app or whatever. And then there's a Jonah, if you email him, he'll give you a code to get 2 months free or a month free or whatever on CISO. You can watch Hidden America. You can watch My Wife.
It's funny that Jonah and I have not had this conversation.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? But I'm like, we talk about everything under the sun.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, I've never said, hey, Jonah, by the way, how can I? And I've asked, obviously, Ernie, and she said, I think Apple TV, She said, I can't remember. Someone else said, you can do it. And she goes, yeah, if you sign up, free trial or a week.
Yeah.
So just binge watch them all. And I'm I just don't know how to. So thank you, Ed. I know how to
No
get
worries.
It now.
But yeah, I feel like Jonah's always a little shy about talking about anything involving people watching him perform a little bit.
Yeah. He's a horrible salesman of himself.
He's done very well. Very well for someone.
In lieu of hiding, trying to hide his talent. So we know Ed's wonderful. That's, if we just were going to find that out, we could close now.
Yeah.
But let's go back to where you were born, when you were born, parents, siblings, that kind of fun stuff.
Wow.
And make it funny. I heard you're funny. So I want to be LOLing.
I was born in.
Not funny at all. Try again.
Oh, man. I was born on 666.
There it is. There one for go. One. See, I think we should end it there. Which, there might be a lot of pressure after that, because that was a one for one. Hit it out of the park. First one.
There you go. I was born on 666 in 76 in Torrejon Air Force Base. I was I'm the sixth child.
There's a real 666 thing to this?
Yeah, yeah. I was the sixth child.
So it wasn't a joke?
No.
So I shouldn't have laughed. So now it doesn't count.
Well, now you're in trouble. and it frightened and immediately created a sense. I think that was an omen. I think it was like a sense of like, well, he's going
what,
to
the
be...
sixth month?
I was born on the sixth day of the sixth month of the sixth year, 1976, and to the sixth... And I'm the sixth child of the sixth child. So, like,
well,
yeah.
That's 666666.
Yeah.
So I think it takes it out of that realm.
Maybe it does. I don't... It did... Because the omen came out that year, and so my...
It came out in 1976?
Yeah, I think that was
goodness.
The whole thing, was that the whole marketing was that, like... You know, it was basically released around my birthday. And so, like, my sister would check my forehead, because they were all, like, much older than me. They were 12 years older than me. I was...
Okay, give me siblings. How old? What do we
got? I have five siblings.
All older. You're the youngest.
They're all much older than me, because my mom remarried. So she was widowed and then remarried.
You have step-siblings.
Yeah. So I have Ron, who... He is basically old enough to be my father. He has a son who's 1 year younger than me. And then,
well, my youngest brother is, yeah, my youngest brother could be my son.
So. Yeah. So it's a big spread, but we all lived in military housing for a little while, because my dad was an officer in the Air Force. And
where?
We lived in Torrejon Air Force Base, then Ramstein. Like, one of my first memories.
Where are these places?
Ramstein is like...
Are you making all this up, Ed?
No. My dad was a top secret...
That was a joke. So if I'm funny, Ed, I'd appreciate it if you'd laugh. Let's be nice to each other. Let's pretend it's Channel 101.
Yeah. These places are all magical but real.
Ramstein.
Ramstein. Like Ramstein. The band Ramstein.
And where? What state?
That's in Germany. So my dad's old job... When I first...
I didn't know we were talking overseas.
Yeah,
we had,
my dad... I'm an Air Force brat.
But where were you born?
Spain.
Overseas.
Madrid.
Oh. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So, we were born... I was born there. My dad's job was background checks for top secret people. And then...
Wow.
In Germany, he would listen to Eastern German radio and translate it. So, like, he would sit there and spend nights. We would go and we'd drop off Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I would watch Charlie's Angels. And my dad would be listening to, like, traffic reports on East German radio, because we hadn't... It's hard to remember, but, like, we didn't know what was going on in Germany and Russia at all. So any sort of information that we could get, we would translate. So my dad spoke German and Russian and Spanish, and he would translate things into English from German and Russian and... do background checks on people and work, you know, CIA. And one of my first memories is just not understanding it, but like I think a garbage truck drove through the security gate and people were worried that it was a bomb, and like everything shut down on base.
You know, it's so funny. I mean, not to interrupt, but
yeah, no, go ahead.
Like right now what's going on in the world, this is kind of the first time I'm kind of like, you know, I kind of get the feeling that I have more of a sense of that stuff now than ever before.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you, because if it was 10 years ago when you talked, I'd be like, wow, what's that like? And now I'm like, yeah, I get a feeling. Again, it's not happened close enough to me for me to claim any.
Yeah, yeah.
But I get and to have that is kind of one of your first, it's like, welcome to the neighborhood, Billy. Yeah.
Well, it is weird, like, because I feel certain people in this world want to go back to that. You know, like, there's these people who are, like, trying to create a war with people who want that Cold War, because, like, the Cold War makes a lot of money for people.
It's just sad how much, like, you know, I remember growing up, and at one point, you know, it's like our debt and the hungry people, and then I heard, like, you know, what they were spending on building planes. I'm like, right. We're not at war right now, but I'm like, how much they're spending? I'm like... And in my head, I couldn't even, like, fathom at all, like, here's what... And so, yeah, I don't even want to get into it, but...
You go, like, oh, it's ridiculous to think build a wall between America and Mexico, but you know that there's like a barbed wire company executive somewhere going like, oh, I kind of hope they do that. You know, like there's concrete company who's going
could
like,
you imagine
who's
yeah, the, who
setting up a
concept?
Bid for
yeah.
it. Yeah. Someone, there is someone who would love to have that business be like, okay, I'll make enough cinder blocks to cover the border between Mexico and California, you know, like,
and then I'll go buy a boat and sit on it the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the environment that I grew up in as a very small child. And it was an interesting, I remember.
So who was in your household when you were growing up? Like that home where you're talking about, who was there?
My brother Chris, my brother Dave, my sisters Laura and Kathy.
Okay, so they were all there.
They were all there.
And your mom and your
And then my mom and my dad.
Your mom and your dad, yes, right.
So, and they were all kind of adolescent at that point. Dave is 12 years older than me. So they were all between like 17 and 12. And we all lived in a, I don't think it was a very big apartment, and I don't remember Spain very much, but I remember being, the only thing I remember about Spain is like my brothers just used me to hit on women. Like you're like Zen. That's what they would do with me. Your dog, they would take me around, and then because there's less children in Europe, people had stopped having babies quite as much. Europe is like retired and we're still in our midlife crisis. And Europe is, like, retired, and they're like, man, we'll have some kids, but we don't need a lot. So a baby in Spain was a huge deal, and I was I'm half Colombian, so I was brown and olive-skinned and curly hair, so I looked Spanish, too, even though I was an American. And so my brothers would take me around and go to, the play.
Ed, you were a prop.
Yeah, I was basically the amount of sins that I helped commit. My brothers, there are upset women in Spain to this day because of me. Like the heartbroken señoritas in Spain because of my brothers Dave and Chris and what they let me. They would just wheel me to the thing and then just they'd put the bonnet down and women would come and pinch my cheeks and then they would
the bait and the hook.
Look, women are. I grew up where meeting women was in a house that meeting women was very important. My brothers learned flamenco dancing. My brothers learned how to speak Spanish because of it. Everything was motivated for them to meet women. So that's what I was used. When we moved to Ramstein, then I got
How old were you then?
I think I was maybe three or four at that point. I got to see Santa Claus almost every day, because Santa was an enlisted man in a Santa Claus uniform, but the girls were all the daughters of officers that had been hired to be elves as a seasonal job. So there's all these cute girls in leggings and elf outfits. So every day my brothers would take me to go see Santa Claus.
It's so funny because, like, okay, so what I remember is, like, this rough, you know, gnarly childhood. And, and then my brothers were picking up chicks.
Yeah.
Simultaneously, this was the beginning of my memories.
Like, every 1980, early 80s, late 70s movie where it's, like, kids hanging out in a pool hall trying to meet women. Like, that's what my brothers were like. Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, going to get...
Weird Science. Weird Science?
Yeah. No, I think it was more like, not the outsiders, but that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, my brother Chris was a fighter kind of guy and was always in trouble and they would sneak away. They still like in when they were in Italy. They stole mopeds and all this stuff that comes out over the holidays. What will happen is like we'll sit at the table eating Thanksgiving or Christmas, and my brothers will throw each other under the bus throughout the meal to make mom love them more. So it'll be like, oh yeah, do you remember when you did this? Do you remember when you did that? Like,
wow, are these two really close in age?
Oh yeah,
like, they're totally competitive.
Yeah, they're really close. Yeah. Well, it's all in good fun.
All right, so let's get to you. I want to talk about Ed. Here to talk about Ed. Let's find out about Ed. So you're growing up. What's Ed like as a child?
I don't know. It's hard to remember. I think I was.
Go to grade school. What were you into sports?
I was.
Did you play with kids? Were you a fighter?
So we moved to Nebraska accidentally in 84. So in Nebraska, Plattsburgh, Nebraska is about 6,000 people.
So you're eight.
I'm eight at that point, and it's cold. It's one of the coldest winters.
It's cold.
It's snowing.
I'm from Minnesota. I know cold.
We had come from Germany, but this was
a different
type of cold.
It's different.
And we moved to a town where there were no minorities, and I'm half Colombian, where everyone's a cousin of somebody. You know, and we're basically kind of interlopers in their world, and it was very isolating. And
wow,
yeah. So I had my own little Cold War, and then I went to public school where I went from being on a military base where there's a lot of child care and health care to like being in a public school in a small town where I was basically treated like a special needs kid, and then eventually they had to pull me out of the public school and take me to a private school because the teachers just refused to engage me because they thought I was so troubled and problematic.
Why did they think that?
Well, I'm at age 35, I was diagnosed with dyslexia. So that's what really the issue was, that I was dyslexic and no one ever...
And it's like you're almost shut down and no one's even trying to break in.
Right.
So there's a big gap and they're going, well, obviously he has a problem.
Well, and I was picked on a lot. So I was very skinny and I was the new kid to town.
God, I get that. And being the different...
And being Latino and like... So those two things. And then also having an undiagnosed learning disability.
Wow, dude.
So it was just sort of like having a bullseye. And so, I just was really picked on. It was pretty miserable.
If we were in grade school,
yeah,
I would have stuck up for you.
I appreciate
my
that.
My first fight was because of that. And my father, I just hated that. I hated seeing kids get picked on.
I went up
to a bully. This was third grade. His name was Keith Sands. And he swore and he talked. You know, it was just like he was a man.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, you know, big-eyed open. Like, who's this guy walking around our class telling people to shut up? I'll kick your ass. And you're like, oh. And he just kept. And one day I go, stop. And then he hit me. And my only father's rule was you can't hit anybody first. But if someone hits you, then go ahead and you'll never get in trouble. And I was fast. No idea why. Yeah. I hit him a bunch of times. We stopped, got done. Like 5 minutes later, I was crying. I was a very sensitive, emotional kid. But I was like, okay. And ever since that, like just listening to that makes me kind of get mad.
Yeah.
Hate that.
It's upsetting.
Hate anybody getting picked on.
To me. I'm
still mad, Ed. Give me a moment.
Breathe. Pet the dog. Touch Zen.
Pet the dog. That's fantastic.
I mean, it's hard to look back and fully know like where,
what came from,
what came from. Because then you know, I also have depression that I deal with. So, and the problem with depression is that it's a lens that you look through, and it affects both forward and backwards. You know, like it. So a lot of times, like
Well put.
Yeah. So I think part of the hard part with depression is you go and you talk to a therapist or whoever, and they'll say, well, you know, think about the good times, and there are none because everything is
clouded.
But I remember there was definitely a good time where there's a Christmas where I got the Millennium Falcon and an X-Wing, and, that was probably the best day.
There's no gray clouds on that day.
Yeah. Like
opening those presents, there were no rain droplets.
So, There were good days, but it is hard to remember. I remember my childhood very tragically and sad, unfortunately. Like, but there were definitely, there had to have been good times. But I got pulled out of public school, put into a Catholic school, which was not much better for me.
I also alumni Catholic school,
nice.
First grade to sixth.
So, which was good because then I also got a lot of religious shame combined with all of that other stuff.
Dude, you got a ton. Honestly, right now, I would honestly say this. The fact that you're alive, above ground, and not nuts in some sort of way, or have done something really bad, is, I mean this wholeheartedly, is a total like success story to me.
Oh.
Because you pick any one of those little things, and you go, oh, and then that's what happened later on, da-da-da. And you got like five of them, dude.
Yeah, I think about that like whenever there's like a like mass shooting or something like that, or like my girlfriend is super into listening to podcasts about serial killers and stuff like that, and it's a lot of the stuff is like, oh, they all have one of the things that
I was just gonna say that. I didn't, like, this is gonna sound really bad, but I'm like, I was gonna say, but you, that's like one thing you got. Yeah. Like four of them. Yeah,
I got really lucky because my brothers and sisters being older were, by the time I'm eight at this point, now they're adults, and they were like second parents to me. So
I was just going
to
say, there was more of your support system than another eight-year-old going, well, these older people who've been around are saying this, so
my brother,
that was probably your savior.
My brother Chris would say something, you know, like, if someone picked on me, my brother Chris said, well, I'll come to school and I'll beat them if I have to. And I was like, no. So I always knew that I had that, like, no matter what, I had
a safety net,
and
I like that.
I always had someone to another apartment to walk to go to my sister Kathy's, or, you know, my sister Kathy take me to ice cream or something like that. So I always had, I was very fortunate in the sense that I had very adult, very cool, chill siblings that kind of were there for me, and that kind of got me through. And I did end up having a few good friends and like playing Dungeons and Dragons and surviving.
No, this was Nebraska?
Yeah, surviving by staying in a basement and talking about Star Trek.
Well, dude, think about it. I mean, when you think, like, you know, getting older and you kind of go, oh, we were, you know, nerds. And it's like, you sit around, it's like, well, no one was saying, come play, you're good at anything. Yeah. You know, people were picking on you. You know, it's like, well, why don't we go in a room by ourselves where no one's going to hurt us, no one's going to pick on us, and we can have fun, and we can pretend, and we can be someone who doesn't get picked on. I mean, it all makes sense to me. You know what I mean? When you think about those things and why people went a certain path.
Well, and I was very... It's funny. I was very young for my grade, because that stuff affects... The difference between being old in a grade and young in a grade is really big. Like, by the time you're... The difference between being 13 and 12 is huge. You could have grown 3 inches in that time.
Yep.
And so I was very young for my grade.
Another thing.
So I was very
I was very
skinny and very, like, fragile. I was always weaker than everybody else, because everyone else was always a year ahead of me, basically. And but I have this, like, really a fond memory is I had a paper route. I started doing paper routes when I was very, very young. But I could barely carry the bag. The bag was bigger than me when I started doing paper routes. And this is like a very...
Did your brothers tow you around because that was cute?
No.
I'm joking.
My family is like very Irish, Catholic, hard work, suffering. My brothers and sisters grew up in a part of Brooklyn that was very...
When I look at you, it screams Irish Catholic.
Yeah. I'm
wow.
But I'm going door to door, and... One of the houses that's on my street was the coach of the good baseball team from Little League. There was always that one team in Little League that, like, had a good pitcher and good players and would beat everybody else. And this is his house, the coach who would coach that team. And so he's like, "Hey, didn't you used to play Little League?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, but I was never very good at it. And he said, "You would have been good at it if I would have coached you." And that meant a lot to me, because it was the first time anyone said this. A lot of the stuff that's...
What year was this?
I was probably 9 or 10.
Probably 24 years ago.
Yeah.
And I know you remember everything about that moment.
Yeah.
That's what I think is so amazing. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
Like, at that moment, this guy goes blah, blah. And I guarantee you, if you said, "I'll give you $1 million if you remember what you said to Ed," he's like, what? You know, because you just throw that. But a child, where you were mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, sitting there, and that guy goes, "You know what? I believe in you. You can do anything." You know, that is like, oh my God.
Yeah.
No one's ever, like, I love those moments.
And I think that that's also a thing that, you know, when you're talking about succeeding or being good at something, or that some of it is you and some of it is environment and who invested in you, who took time, you know,
it means a lot.
It means a lot. If your dad never played catch with you and then you go and you play baseball, you're gonna be terrible. But if your dad's the kind of dad who's gonna play catch with you, then you're gonna be better at baseball right away. And if you're better at baseball right away, then you're going to get to start. And if you get to start, you get to play more. And it's really a domino effect. And in whatever... Athletics is an easy way to make a metaphor for it, but in whatever thing you're doing, like, sometimes it's hard to get that first thing to fall, that first domino, and have someone invest in you and help you.
Well, that's a great point, because I don't think very many people walk up to a young child and go, look, you're going to do this. It's not going to be, like, great. It's not going to be wonderful. But if you stick to it in the future, it's going to have value. Young kid look at that and go, what are you talking about? Now, there are other kids that try something once and they're great at it and they run with it. But it's hard to, you know, say, no, Ed, look, like, you're not as good as these other kids, but I'm telling you, it's okay. Don't worry about that. We're going to go over here. I'm going to get you good at this. I'm going to get you feeling good. You're going to become familiar, and then you're going to feel confident. And when you feel confident, you're going to feel comfortable. And then you can go play. You know, it's like, ooh. If you just could have had that person.
I
didn't have that person in my life either.
I love music, and I wish I wish I would have learned to play music. And there's always this saying people always say, which is like, oh, find the thing that you love and do that and you'll be successful.
Yep.
But what's funny is that the part that people leave out is that, like, a lot of the people I know who are professional musicians, it's not like they wandered into something and found a piano and sat down on it. Their parents made them take piano lessons. And then,
No. You know, happens, Ed. You get a knock on the door, yeah. Roll a piano in, and you go, this must be my thing.
Yeah, a magic mandolin shows up.
Number one, I love that statement, but one, I used to be baffled by someone's, like, you know, because I joined karate, I was 18.
Yeah.
And it was a big thing to me.
Yeah.
All through high school, I was like, I heard people join, like, how do you join karate? How do you know about karate? Like, how do you? I was just kind of in the back of my mind because I heard a couple kids, oh, you know, that kid's a green belt. And I'm like, they don't have that in school. How do you, you know, and I wasn't creative at all.
Yeah.
I didn't do I didn't, you know, I was like, because no one was saying, hey, you should try or you should. It was just like, well, my father, you know.
Right.
Crazy. Yeah. I forgot what the other thing I was going to say. Go ahead, keep talking.
But, you know, I think that's the thing. I think we're in a different place now to where you can Google, if you want to do something, you can Google it and kind of, like, figure it, or Bing, Jonah, Ray, Bing, and, or Bing it. You can find how to do it. I remember in 2000, there was a Bob Odenkirk and David Cross website. I was a huge Mr. Show fan, and I messaged the webmaster of that website saying, how do I start doing comedy? And no one responded to me because it was just, I didn't know. A webmaster is just a person who's writing HTML code. You know, they have no association with the comedy side of things. But that's how hard it was to find a starting point for things back, you know, when I was a kid. So now I remember there's a...
Oh, this was what I was going to say. I was baffled by sometimes, like, how did that person start? And the other thing is, like, how do you know about certain things like that? I was like, yeah. Then I found out, like, a kid was 8 and they were a black belt. I'm like, who put you in karate at 4? You know, like, that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah. So that, like, I got to a certain point. That's what my other point I was going to say. Yeah. Was, like, sitting there going, because I love what you pointed out. I was like, well, find what you love. And it's like, I don't know where to look, dude. And why am I looking? Because I should believe that there's something out there that, and, you know, kind of what, I mean, I think we got a whole lot in common as right. children, but my father, I came back, like, I could fight.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with it. I was fast. Nothing to do with it. These are just things. So sixth grade rolls around, I go to join football. I'm obviously going to be, you know, because I'm good at it. Yeah. And this is, like, the first time, and they pass out pads. And I think I shared this on one of my podcasts, but I got these pads, and the coach comes up, and he goes, I think you're going to be our new quarterback. And I was like, whoa! I was like, can I go home? My dad goes, who's going to cut the grass when you're at football practice? And I remember, like, when I said that memory, yeah. I remember John Mose coming over and me giving my friend to return my football pads. I remember going back into my room and sitting down and looking out the window and going, can't someone else cut, like, can I cut the grass? Any other, like, I'm like, all these boys are playing football. Yeah. And I got to cut the biggest gap. Like, I was like, where those fathers are letting, do you know what I mean? Like, I was just like, again, I was like, well, I can only work with what I'm taught or given.
Right. Yeah. I think it's, and I think that, as you get older, you go, oh, parents are just, especially once you get to the age that your parents were when you...
They're going, they're transferring the information that they knew.
Yeah. They're, like, if my dad was older, I think he was 32 when I was born, but, you know, he was a dummy. I was a dummy, too, at 32. I'm a dummy now. I talk about getting older. I'm like, the only thing getting older does is that you've touched more parts of the hot stove. You know, like, that's...
that's a great line.
You're just like, oh, I burned myself here and here and here.
Well, I concur with that again because I was, you know, people, if they give me a compliment or something, I'm like, look, I'm just, you know, I'm 51. I've walked in the woods longer. And I go, hey, Ed, when you get to the bridge, the sign says go left, go right. Yeah. Tom's amazing. Oh, my God, he's psychic. No, I've been walking in the woods longer. And when I got to the bridge, I found out that. So that's kind of how I feel. I'm just like you said, hey, I've burned myself enough times to know some things. I've got some experience based on some, or wisdom based on some experience.
Yeah, and I think that that's, how are we doing it?
Good? Perfect. No, yeah. I just keep checking because one time it stopped.
Oh, okay, okay.
And everybody I told had a podcast and they looked at me and they go, yeah, I know. And I was like, no, but I was recording this. And they go, yeah. Like three people, I think it was like Jonah, Chris, and I think Matt or something like that. And they're like, oh, so I should, and I was like, so now, because there was no like the light's on, it never goes,
yeah, it doesn't
oh,
blink
when the light blinks, it stopped recording, or, so I've just out of habit.
No, no, it's
always
good habit.
Over. So you're good, good, good.
Habits
good.
Are good. I think that's, but yeah, we're only through my adolescence. We're not even to me, I haven't even hit puberty yet. We haven't gotten very
far. No, Nebraska,
far
how long are we, how old are you, or when did you leave Nebraska?
I left Nebraska when I was 21.
Oh, so you were there.
I went to high school, went
so
to college.
In high school, did you get into comedy, drama?
Nothing. I took
sports. Were you sports?
I played football, but I did it out of... So I played football in grade school. I was always bad. There was one year where I was the only person on the third string. Like, it was like you would see the depth chart. You go to the wall and you see the depth chart, and everything's like too deep for every position. Who's the starter? Who's the backup? Who's the starter? I was the only person who was the third alternate for a position. And so...
Do you have that on your resume?
I don't.
You should throw that
the
on
the only third string player. and
unique
so
skills.
I started working, washing dishes, so I stopped playing football my eighth grade year. But then I went to high school and started playing football, mainly because I didn't know anybody. And so I had no friends. I went to a Catholic school that was 40 minutes from my home. So, and the guy I got a ride with played football.
You went to a Catholic high school?
I went to a Catholic high school.
Wow.
So either I was going to sit there for an hour and a half while he was at football practice, or I was going to just be at football practice too. So I just started playing football. And, my freshman year, if you don't know about football, there's face masks. There's different face masks for what position, depending on how much protection you need and how much visibility you need. So, yeah. A lineman has a lot of bars because he doesn't really need to see that much, and needs protection. I played cornerback and wide receiver, which should have the least amount of bars and the least amount of protection. But I have a gigantic head. Like I have a 7 3.
Ladies and gentlemen, he could barely fit inside the door.
Yeah, we had to use one of those cranes to bring me up through a window, and. So I had this huge helmet, and I weighed 120 pounds, and they put the football pads on me, and I looked sort of like a scarecrow that you would keep, you know, put in the crops. And then when I would run down the field, my giant helmet with this heavy, big face mask would float. So it just looked like a Pez dispenser running down the field, just like this little, like, scrawny.
Wow.
Yeah, it was real terrible. But
I commend the fact that you did it, though.
Yeah, and I always had...
Like, what made you show up every day? Because you weren't banging dudes and going, yeah, I like that.
People would fight to be... Like, when you do tackle drills, people would be like, I want to get Ed. Like, people would be like...
Did you feel loved and appreciated, Ed, because of that?
I got...
I'm so popular, Mom and Dad. They get in a line, Mom and Dad.
Somewhere out there is video from a local news station of me getting a concussion because we had a really good football team. The varsity football team was really good my sophomore year, and they had us on like skeleton D, and the news was there to cover our offensive players, and the running back comes around the corner And it's just supposed to be like for show, and he just crushes me, and I don't remember anything after that. For I'm pretty sure I lost a good chunk of my senior year, sophomore year, like just gone. But yeah, no,
So we graduate high school.
I graduate high school.
What's your plan? Did you have a plan?
I have no plan. Like, I graduated high school.
Real quick, mom and dad, loving, supportive. What were they? Kind of present, not doing the best they can.
My parents are weird because
that was the first word that came out was weird.
My mom's dad passed away when she was 9. Then my mom's mom was not around. I don't think I've never met any of my grandparents. My dad's mom. My dad's dad died when he was young, and then his mom passed away. So he moved to America to live with his sister, I think when he was 12. So neither of them have, like, parents, really. They were both kind of orphans. So that's kind of a big part of it, of, like, my relationship with them. They're as supportive as they're capable of being.
I'm just going to say there's got to be a lot of independence that just happens because it's like...
Yeah.
Just look what happens. No one's here.
Yeah.
Take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. It's yeah. And they don't have like the thing of like how grandparents treat children, their grandkids. Like they don't have that as a model. They don't have. Yeah. So
doing what they can with what they have.
Yeah. So I constantly had to be like, oh, I want to be in. I was in wrestling in grade school.
I did too.
I was in band. But it was all me going, like, I want to be engaged in things. Because otherwise, I would have just sat in the basement for hours and not had any friends and been by myself.
So, your parents were cool. They weren't suggesting or anything, but they didn't say no, which is cool.
Yeah. But I there was definitely a lot of, like, anger and, like, bad vibes in my house. So, I deal with that a lot. My dad is very high strung and he's a little bit chill now, but he went from having no children to having six. So he didn't get to ramp up being a dad.
Well, it's cool that you look for kind of, or you look through your father's eyes a lot. You do that a lot. That's a cool trait.
Yeah. I mean, I can be super mad about things, I guess. But it's not helpful.
No.
One thing that, like, anyone out there who has either violence in their home or any problems and they're trying to get traction, one thing that from going to therapy, my therapist said one time, I was like, well, what kind of relationship do you want? What kind of relationship do you want to be in? I said, well, I just don't want to have the same marriage that my parents had. And he said, well, that's not an answer. Like, a negative is not an answer. Because saying, I want to do the opposite.
That's what I don't want, yeah.
Yeah, saying what you don't want is still infinite. Like, you'd be like, well, you're doing is...
Yeah, you're not saying what you want. Right. You're just saying what you don't want, and that really means nothing.
Yeah, the you can be like, oh, I don't want the same relationship my parents have. And you can be like, oh, you want to be two alcoholics living in Las Vegas and smoking cigarettes and gambling.
Not your parents.
That's not your parents. So you have to, like, stop... You have to look at your family and go, like, well, understand who they are and then decide where you want to be and what you want to be. So,
bravo.
That was like a big part of it. But yeah. And also, I think I have to look, because there are times where, because my temperament comes from my dad a lot. So if I don't sort of accept what he is, then it makes it hard for me to be me, if that makes sense.
Okay, so we're in college.
So I'm in college, and things are much... By college, like, I kind of bloomed, I guess, you know? Because once again, like, I was a year younger than everybody. By the time I got to college, I filled out. I started exercising. There's not a lot to do in Nebraska. A lot of times,
and
it's
that's
very
a big
cold.
Football,
so
you know, Bible, like, that area right there, especially Nebraska, so...
College football is the biggest thing in the state. And so the university has a lot of facilities, like 5 indoor basketball courts, 6 indoor racquetball courts, a full indoor football field that we play football on. Like, and so I spent a lot of time in college. I worked at the rec center. I trained people a little bit. Like, when I was 17, my friend had a Henry Rollins spoken word CD.
What?
Henry Rollins.
Oh, okay.
Spoken word CD. And that was kind of, me, that was the thing that stopped me, that was like, okay, well, his whole thing was, well, if you're mad about something, the best revenge is being successful, which is not super healthy, but it'll get you out of Plattsburgh, Nebraska, and get you into college and get you working out, get you taking care of yourself, and stop you from being an alcoholic like some of your friends, and stop you from settling for a life and trying to find a life.
Is that kind of how you felt?
That's how I felt. I spent...
Were you starting to drink?
I started drinking in seventh grade.
And seventh grade?
Yeah, we would sneak out and because... In Nebraska,
well, again, I was gonna say, dude, Nebraska, like places like that, people go, dude, there's nothing to do, and people just look for trouble.
Well, also, people in Nebraska, every garage has at least two refrigerators or freezers. So, like, you have your refrigerator in your house in Nebraska.
It's that common.
You have a refrigerator in your garage that has beer and sodas, and then you have a deep freezer with meat in it.
Yeah,
and people don't lock things. So we knew our friends. We knew which dads had beers in the garage, so you could go in. Take like a 12-pack for you and your friends, which is enough beer for, you know, seventh graders to get super drunk on.
Oh, totally.
And we would start drinking. My friends stole a bunch of alcohol. I wasn't there when they did it, and they put it in a broken down car in this field. And it was funny, you could tell that it was kids who stole it because they stole buckets of alcohol, like bottles of alcohol. And also candy. So this trunk of this broken down...
sounds good. Comet. Beer and candy.
Yeah, this broken down Comet was like Baby Ruth's and Canadian Hunter whiskey. And I remember walking down the train tracks at 1 a.m. after sneaking out of the house with two other friends and drinking Canadian Hunter whiskey. I drank vodka and hated it. I had drank beer. I never liked it. But the moment I drank whiskey, I was like, this is the best thing ever. And so, and I was like, it tasted great. I could drink Canadian Hunter whiskey, which is terrible whiskey, straight in seventh grade. And so,
that's insane. I can't even drink that. I've never been able to. I hate, like, liquor, taste of it across the board.
Whiskey I don't drink very often. I maybe drink once a week, I'll have a drink or whatever, but like whiskey is definitely something like religious.
So what causes a seventh grader to sneak out of a house to go get alcohol and get drunk? Were you running, chasing, just not?
Well, I didn't, I finally
that's
was
like,
starting
I, to... cause I get a little bit of feeling how you... I think you were a lot like me in a way. And I'm like, poof, dude, I wasn't... Because my father was very... I got in trouble all the time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It wasn't fun. So I got punished hard. So I didn't get in trouble. And I'm thinking, I would not even think about doing... I'm like, wait a minute. You said this, 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 and this. And you're this fragile little blah, blah, blah. And it's like... And then you had the balls to do that?
Yeah, I
or were you just following?
I just wanted friends, I think. And that was how...
So you're just following.
Following. Yeah, and also because I went, there was a small Catholic school, grade school where I went, and a slightly bigger, both are small compared to like California and New York schools, but like my grade school had 8 other people in my class, you know? So, and I was friends with one of them. And even the people I was friends with beat the shit out of me. So I wanted other circles of friends. And I
can understand that.
So these were public school kids. Yeah. These are public school kids, so to have friends who were actually friends, I had to sneak out of the house at night. You know,
so you were trying to fit in.
I was trying to fit
this
in.
This is what these guys are doing. I want to be in the group, so let me...
But not in a peer pressure way. I wasn't like, oh, these guys are going to think
no,
I'm cool.
No, but it's you want. I want to participate
right.
with kids, and that's what they're doing, so I'll go. It was
right.
like you sitting there going, look, I really want to drink. I want
right.
to go break some laws.
Yeah, and so we... we would just sneak out, and we most of the time we did almost nothing. We just walked around. We'd walk around, go to different places, go to friends' houses. If someone's parents were heavy sleepers or worked night shift, we would go there and hang out. We would try to like get girls to make out with us. We would just wander. It was
So did the drinking ever become a thing that you started in seventh grade? And it's the weirdest story I've ever heard. They're like, yeah, guess what? I love whiskey. I'm 12. Did that become a problem ever?
No, because what happened was my dad found a bottle of vodka in my room. And that was a whole incident. And then between that and hearing about like straight edge punk stuff a little bit, as much as you could in the, you know, the early 90s in Platts, Nebraska, those two things kind of like collided to where I was like, well, I don't want to drink. And so when in high school, when my friends were all starting to drink, I was not drinking. All my friends were like, oh, I remember friends specifically talking about the first time they ever got drunk, and I was like, oh, I did that when I was in seventh grade. I went through that. And so
I'm a sophomore and I'm sitting around telling stories to the kids.
Yeah this is what it, so when I went to college, I didn't start drinking until college again, and even then it was very like tempered. And so I never super, which was good, because a lot of people, if anyone wants advice to get through college, it's like, college a lot of times is about holding your breath, not swimming fast, you know? Like, a lot of my friends who didn't make it through because they just got super drunk all the time, and it's really hard to get through college.
It's probably difficult to do anything
it's
of any value at any point anywhere if you're super drunk a lot.
So as bad as like starting drinking in seventh grade was, it kind of was good for me in a way, just because I ended up skipping the phase that everyone else had.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. I don't ever think there's right or wrong anymore. I truly don't, and I can prove it. It's really then what do you do after that and from that? It's like, well, I did that. It's like, okay, well, now what? Well, I didn't after that. Okay. I don't see it as a bad thing. Now, again, would you want your child? Would you want anyone you know to start drinking? Of course not. But if someone went through it past tense and they're better now, win-win.
Yeah, I mean, it really is, as you get older, it really is. I always think about keeping your head on a swivel was sort of a football phrase that I remember, which I always think about, which is kind of always keeping your eyes open, keep being aware, because you never know where the hit's going to come from, which is my least favorite thing about football. Never knowing. I didn't mind getting hit. I hated not knowing where it was going to come from. And so, it's about kind of being aware of your surroundings at all times, you know, and prepping for it. And, I think that having that sort of adolescence was good for me in a way, because it did give me friends, which I didn't have before.
Well, I was just going to say, being in Nebraska, being a football state, you playing football and you kind of, you know, having these friends, I mean, you have to start going, okay, I'm starting to fit in. I'm starting to feel better. I'm working out. I'm affecting people. All right. I found my little place.
Yeah. By the time I got to college, like,
what were you pursuing in college? Or what did you go to college for?
Sociology.
Okay.
So I wanted to go to law school eventually. It was kind of like the
plan.
The end. Yeah. I mean, the thing of sociology is the scientific study of human behavior in the macro. And that appealed to me because it helped explain a lot of my life. Like, it helped me like understand.
I get that totally. You were searching.
I was trying to understand like why were things so hard for me at times.
Oh, I'm right there with you, dude. I totally understand that, Ed. I do.
And so when sociology doesn't remove responsibility from any singular person, but it does put, it was the first thing that had perspective, that was like, okay, like,
instead of here's what happened to me, it's like, okay, great, well, now what are you going to do?
Yeah, because growing up in the Midwest and growing up in a Catholic environment, the solution to everything is like work harder and pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Is like, well, and sociology was the first thing that said, well, not everybody gets boots even. You know, Bo Jackson didn't have shoes growing up, and he would have to wait in his house while his sister sat by the bus stop because it would be so cold, and then she would yell back to the house to tell him that the bus was there, and then he'd have to run to the bus. It's like, he didn't even have fucking shoes.
That's so cool.
You know what I mean? Like,
that's so such a great story.
When anyone tells you, like, well, you just need to work harder or whatever. It's like, yeah, but I don't even have shoes, man. Like that. And I didn't know I was dyslexic until I was 35, but that's really what.
How old are you now?
I'm 40 now.
Okay.
I turned 40 just this year. You know, I didn't know at the time, but that was really what that was about. It was like feeling that I was putting as much effort into things as everyone around me and not getting anywhere was a really big problem. And so sociology was at least something that kind of showed that.
Kind of gave you some clarity.
Right.
Some, like, I'm not broken.
Right, and that you don't control every aspect of this world. We want to believe that we control.
Oh, yeah, you're bad because something you're not right. doing right, or you should be doing more of something. It's like, no, right. that's not all your responsibility.
Right, it's. I always think about that. There's that ad for retirement that is the couple will be there, and there's like a green arrow, and like they're like follow this green arrow to your retirement.
Yeah,
and it's like it's this idea that they're telling you like you. The people who aren't ready for retirement aren't following their green arrow. It's like, well, you could follow that green arrow, and then Enron could...
And it doesn't mean nothing.
Could go bankrupt, and then you could
write down anything you want as a plan. You can invest in that plan. It don't mean nothing.
So that drew me to sociology, and I liked law, and I liked sociology, because when I got to college, I was dyslexic, which I didn't know. So writing things was... I did really well in multiple choice questions. I do very well in sort of theoretical, analytical questions, but my grammar, spelling, always bad. But in sociology, they cared more about my ideas than they cared about my grammar
context,
and spelling.
Context, got it.
And when I got to college, talking became... When I was in grade school and high school, I was punished for talking in class. But because writing was hard, expressing myself verbally was always better. But you're told not to talk basically for the first 12 years of school. And then when I got to college, everyone else was shy and I was ready to talk. And I would talk during class and I would say things. And so class participation became a much bigger part. So all of a sudden I went from being like a high D, low C to a B, A student. Because all of a sudden I was engaged because it was like, I want to be ready to sound smart in class. I know that I'm going to talk. I can't fight talking. I know that it's going to happen. So I better be on point when I say things. And the other thing is that there's a book called The Gift of Dyslexia, which if you're dyslexic, everyone should read. But one of the things, what dyslexia does to your brain is that your brain is constantly trying to build three-dimensional models, essentially. That's why the words move. Your brain is trying to pick up the two-dimensional things and flip them and look around and understand what it is. And so your brain is constantly looking at other perspectives. So I often feel like what that does and what would it do in sociology is like coming up with solutions and ideas that other people wouldn't have. Because my brain is constantly going like, well, what's on the other side of this thing?
Got it.
So
going, I work this way. So instead of trying to undo that, why don't I just go with it and find out how I can benefit from this thing that is that way?
Your brain wants to constantly extrapolate and not just learn. So your brain is like, okay, and if that, then this. And then if that, then this. What does this image mean? What does this thing mean? That's why looking at letters is hard, because letters are symbols and have no real meaning.
No.
And your brain is going like, well, what is this? Is this a cat? C-A-T. Is this actually a cat? Like, what does a cat look like? So that became an advantage in college. And all my professors really liked me at that point. So I went from having... In high school and grade school, being treated like...
Wow, that's trippy, dude. Yeah, 180.
Yeah, being treated very poorly and being put in the halls and being told not to talk, and to where I would, like, senior year, people would come up to me who were in my freshman classes and be like, I remember you. You were so funny. You were cool. You were so smart in class. Like, people would come up and compliment me. People knew me because I was in class and engaged and talking in a way, and obviously there are people who, if you've ever taken a college class, that talk There's nothing worse than when a professor goes like, you guys can leave if anyone doesn't have any questions, and then someone asks a question.
Yes.
That's a nightmare. Like, just stay after and ask that question. That's anyone who's in college right now, there's nothing wrong with just hanging out afterwards and asking your professor that question instead of making the whole class stay.
Yes.
But I would never do that, but just being a part of... I just became really engaged in college and kind of like became who I was supposed to be.
So did you finish? Did you graduate?
I graduated, and then I'd met this guy who worked at Toshiba, who was from Nebraska, and he hired me to be his assistant in North Carolina, which was a place I vacationed. I loved North Carolina, and I still do. North Carolina is very beautiful. It's very much like, it's a slightly more humid California.
Okay.
And so
assistant to what?
In temperature, like
no assistant. He said he hired his assistant.
So we worked for Toshiba regional sales for
his assistant there. Okay.
Yeah, so LCD battery and SAW filters, which are in cell phones, and at the time people were just starting to buy cell phones, so people didn't have cell phones in, let's say, I think 95 is when we were starting to see cell phones. By 2000, people are now getting to the point where everyone needs to have a cell phone. And so business was very good, a lot of money. I got paid very well. And so I was like, well, I'll go to North Carolina. I'll get residency there. I'll save up money, pay off my car, and then I'll apply for law schools in North Carolina because North Carolina has a ton of really good universities. I'll be in state. I can either have Toshiba pay for my law school.
Wow.
Or I'll just save up money and stop working at Toshiba and go to law school. And at the time, college wasn't quite as expensive as it is now. So in 2 years, I was like, I could easily have enough money saved up to where I could live off of it for 3 years of law school if I go full-time year-round. So that was my goal. I visited the Lincoln Law School. That was my plan. And then September 11th happened, and the economy went into the tank, and the Toshiba sold a big chunk of our division off. So then I was laid off. And
so again, had this plan.
Yeah, plan was destroyed. And so then I moved to D.C. with a girl I was kind of dating long distance, and one of my best friends lived in D.C., and I lived in D.C. and sold laboratory supplies, and then she was like, I'm going to L.A. You can either come or you can stay here. And I was like, I hated D.C., just miserable there. And I was like, okay, I'll go to L.A. And so then I came to L.A., and then she broke up with me.
What year was that?
That was 2002, I think.
Okay.
And then she broke up with me, and then I was unemployed, essentially homeless and heartbroken. And I'm walking down 3rd Street, which is where there's a lot of brunch spots in L.A. And I went to Dope. My friend took me to Dope Boys, which is like a diner, which is like the first place I ever had a red velvet cupcake, too. The first time I ever saw red velvet cupcakes. So we went to Dope Boys, which has this amazing French onion soup. And we're walking to go back to our car. And going back to Rammstein, when you're on a base, you only have one TV channel. So that's English speaking. So on our channel was the shows that you'd see was this show called Baba Black Sheep. Benny Hill was on there. Monty Python was on there.
All comedies.
Saturday Night Live, Happy Days. These were the most important things. That and Star Wars, those are the only things that were important to me growing up as a kid. And I used to have a Fonz t-shirt, and I would do the Fonz. Hey! My mom would make me do it. And so I'm walking down the street.
I love that you had to throw that in there. My mom, I never voluntarily just did it. Okay? My mother made me do it. Move on.
So then I'm walking down the street, and I'm in my head, I'm just like, well, I'll move back to Plattsmouth. It's 4 years later than I thought it would be, but I'll just hang out in my parents' basement, save up money, take the LSAT, go to law school. And as I'm walking down the street, I look up, and Henry Winkler's there. Henry Winkler is the Fonz.
Now, where's this at?
On Happy Days, on 3rd Street Promenade.
Okay, I shook hands with Henry Winkler. Where? Do you guess I shook hands with Henry Winkler?
Jones on 3rd?
3rd Street Promenade.
Yeah.
I swear, he's walking out of the movie theater and I was walking in. It's just such a weird thing that I'm like, I'm not starstruck at all. I could care less.
No.
But I was just saying, I looked up and he's such a good guy. And I just looked up and he looked right at me and it was almost we both put up. But
yeah, he,
to meet someone on 3rd Street Promenade just like you did, that's a weird thing.
He looks at you and he looked at me. And he's got these really kind eyes.
Yeah.
And he has this face, he has this look that says, I know that you recognize me and it's okay.
There you go.
And you, and it's also this, there's no fear in him.
And that's a skill, I think.
And he, and you just, and so you don't feel this impulse to like, feel,
yeah, I should, what should I do? It's just like, oh, hi.
He's just like,
he's
you're saying it's okay. You just saw the Fonz. It's okay. And I just remember looking, thinking like, I can't leave where the Fonz lives.
And that's so that, what kept you here.
That's what kept me here.
Now, this is a great story. Do you know that? Like, this is a guy contemplating law school for the second time.
Yeah.
Guess what happened? He met the Fonz.
And
his whole plan changed.
I'm the jukebox he punched. You know?
I'm the jukebox Henry Winkler punched.
I know we're getting long, so
T-shirt.
But
that's a T-shirt.
I'll loop this back to current day. So stayed here, ran into this girl at a bar. She was a comedian. That got me into this thing called Hollywood Hell House, which like Patton Oswalt, Chip Pope, Doug Benson, these the producers of 6 Feet Under and the producers of Arrested Development were involved in it. Is at the Steve Allen Theater where the Tomorrow Show is, which is one of my favorite stand-up shows in L.A. All of that is happening, and that's, and then she's doing a one-woman show, and I help her write some jokes for it, and then she says, you should do stand-up, and I start doing stand-up. 2 weeks ago, Patton Oswalt goes on Conan O'Brien, right? And he walks out, and he talks about his wife's death, and it's great, and it's hilarious. And I have this, like, realization. Because maybe law school was what I was supposed to do and I just made a mistake, but I had this realization that whether or not like I'm successful at stand-up or I may never get a Comedy Central special and I may never sell a pilot, but watching him deal with what is the worst tragedy in his life through stand-up, what all of this was about me learning how to do stand-up because that's what I need to not die. That's what I need in my life to be able to deal with the negative things in this world. It
balances you.
It balances you. It teaches you to process tragedy. It teaches you to deal with the negative things in this world in a way that's positive. And for me, no, that's not necessarily for everybody, but watching him do that made me go like, well, that's why I did stand up. I did stand up because if I would have gone to law school and I would have become a lawyer, I still would have been sad and I still would have been depressed and I still would have not been able to deal with the world and I still would have been uncomfortable in my own skin and I still would not have really looked at who I was and been happy with it. I would have always been unhappy. And so I think that's why things happen the way they happened in LA for me.
You know? Bravo. I love that, dude. I love that. Because the Patton Oswalt thing that, you know, affected me in a sense, like, you know, dude just wakes up one day, sees his wife, thinks he says snoring, takes his 7-year-old daughter to school, comes back and she's gone.
Yeah.
His wife. Like, I was like, and I've gone through a lot, not more than anyone else, but in the last year and a half, I say it's the best year and a half of my life, and there's just certain things I get now, and I'm just moving forward. Mm-hmm. Like, I get it, just move forward. Things happen. Everything that happens to me is teaching me something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I try to pull everything out and just do it differently than I did it for 49 years. We have a lot of similarities, a lot of things in common, and I don't know, it's cool because there's part of me, or well, I see part of you that fights really hard to be in this one place because that's the one place where you feel okay.
Yeah.
And I understand that wholeheartedly. That's why I can verbalize it. Because I had to undo almost everything I was taught and then go, okay, that's not good. Now let me find good. Let me learn this just so I can be okay. And then I felt, you know what? I'm okay. And I thought, and this is when I realized I would share a story with someone and then they would feel better. And I'd like, well, that made me feel better. So I realized that I was kind of doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing because it made me feel good. And I just did my 100th episode.
Congrats.
Thank you. And my Vin Scully just retired like last weekend. And in his speech at Dodger Stadium, the last one, and I put this in my introduction, he said to the audience, he said, I've needed you far more than you've needed me. And it was cool because that dude, he's a legend and all that stuff. So you knew he's just authentic. That was gold. So you felt that statement. But just like that, because I was thinking about, you know, the 100th podcast or whatever, and I go, that's how I feel. Because if you took that podcast out of my life and I was not doing that, I would not have. And I thought about all I've gained, plus my dog, in the last year and a half,
yeah,
over that period of the last 100 episodes, the people I've met, the stories I've heard, the relationships I've bought. I mean, I'm like, and I love what you said. I do that, so I feel this. Mm-hmm. Why do I want to feel this? Because I never have. What am I going to do the rest of my life? Feel this. So what am I going to keep doing? Exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that. That's a sense of clarity. What was it that got you like, oh, I'm actually in comedy? I mean, that's a big step. You just kind of started kind of writing and you kind of like, oh, hey, I'm good at it? Or was, you know, we were talking about before when you were younger, no one said, hey, do this and get good at it. Someone had to say, because the first thing you didn't write didn't.
I think Anthony Jeselnik, someone, I was at an open mic and I had my notes down. I'm dyslexic. I didn't know I was dyslexic. So a lot of my early stand-up is me looking at a notebook and trying to read my own writing, which is, you have bad penmanship when you're dyslexic. And then your anxiety makes your dyslexia even worse. So then you're trying to read your bad penmanship while looking at your notes while you're feeling anxiety.
See, that just sounds like fun. Sounds like a bunch of funny to me.
So I had this notebook and I was at this open mic. It was like a hookah bar sort of thing where everyone's on a couch. And this one comic, I use that in quotes, this one guy purposely puts his legs up and knocks my notes off the table. And then Anthony Jeselnik gets up after me and goes and points at him and goes, you're never going to be anything. And he's going to keep working.
Just like that.
And just like that. And then I was like, okay, it just took one person to kind of like.
I love
it. So it's
that.
Anthony's fault if I still do comedy.
That's a great story and a great thing. I love Anthony. Like, yeah. I literally love Anthony because that's what I would have wanted to do in that moment, either punch him or say something. But I mean, to have the calm and look at him going, you're never going to be anything.
Yeah.
And he's going to keep working.
And he's right.
I love that.
I mean, like, and either I'm working hard so that Anthony's right or working,
but again,
because he
isn't
was
that
right.
Funny because you go back to that one football coach who said, if I were, and you said that like it happened yesterday,
yeah,
and then you're thinking with Anthony going, why I've never done comedy. I'm here, it's like, I really, I got you, all right, I'm gonna do this now just because somebody, yeah, and I get that, like, you can be so yearning for just that one pet,
yeah,
that one stroke, that one affirmation, that if you get it, you're like, okay, I like this. It feels good. I'm going to stay here. It doesn't have to make much more sense than that.
Yeah, and then I think the other thing is, once I knew that there was a comedian, Michelle Balloon, who's very, very funny. She lives in Philadelphia now. If you live in that area, find her. She's great. But I was in Portland doing a comedy festival and she made me not take my notes on stage for the first, not have a set list, not notes, but just like a set list. I always had a set list. She said, don't do that anymore. And that was when things changed for me. And then I didn't know at the time.
And she also obviously believed in you in a
sense. She believed in me. Yeah. She's like, you don't need
it. Love those people. I just do. I love those people when I hear these stories. Because again, I have this kindredship, a fondness for you. And when I hear about someone helping you along the way, I'm like, I love that person.
And then I think, Jonah one time introducing me as a funny improviser was like very nice, and I remember that very distinctly. And then
wow.
The fact that Jonah has like brought me into the meltdown and all that stuff, I think that's always been a big part of it. So,
well, that's what I was going to get into next, is kind of how that happened, you and Jonah. And again, that's because, again, I love Jonah. Like, that's like, you know, on the record.
Yeah.
And then he says, hey, Ed, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, done. You know, just like, you are this guy. So I was thinking, well, if you've been friends and he's been having you be involved and calling you up, I mean, yeah, that's got to be a good hug affirmation.
Well, the first comedy show I came to, and first stand-up comedy show I went to in L.A. was produced by this guy named Jason Nash. It was in West Hollywood. The comedians were Josh Fadem, Kyle Kinane, Harden Firm, which is Chris Hardwick, and Furman. Mike Furman, and Jonah Ray.
No way.
And I talked to Jonah afterwards. Jonah and I talked. I remember specifically the conversation, and I was not doing comedy at the time. So
you're just an audience member.
I was just talking.
And you just went up to him and said, hey, I liked your set, and we just started chatting.
Yeah, we both liked MST3K. We both liked kind of like bad
things. Oh, dude,
is
that weird right now, what you're talking about, and then what just happened like last week?
Yeah.
When was this? What year was this that you're talking to him for the first time?
This is like 2004, 2005 maybe.
Dude, that's 11 years ago, and you say MST3.
That's stupid.
And
I remember specifically talking.
And for those people that don't know, Jonah Ray is one of the people responsible for helping bring back Mystery Science 3000, and he just got done filming it this past 2 weeks.
Which is a show that I used to watch in my basement.
So did I.
Yeah.
So did I.
And so I know we talked about how no matter where the General Lee jumped off, when the Dukes of Hazzard generally, no matter where, if you watch that show, it's like, no matter where it launches, it cuts to the same jump over a swamp that they've used a million times. So it's like, they could be in New York City and be like, we got a jump, and then it's like,
cut to swamp.
Swamp in the South, like, they just got real lazy with it. And that was our first conversation, and then
that was you and Jonah's first conversation. Was the laziness of
Dukes of Hazzard. I don't know if he remembers it or if he even liked it. But then we would hang out. We did improv at the UCB together. And then I did this show called Terminant Nerds, which is still going on. But the kind of thing I did was, it was the first time they did Terminant Nerds. It was over a couple of days. And everyone was doing it as like a real debate, and I was like, oh, The Predator was one of my favorite movies growing up, so I chose to be the Predator. And the whole thing was supposed to be who would win in a fight, and they seeded everybody, and I was seeded against Superman, so I knew I was going to lose. So then I said, well, who could win this? And so I dressed up as Atticus Finch and did the whole thing as Atticus Finch, and then I got second place in the tournament. I lost to Darth Vader in the final round. And it went to the audience. It went to basically a draw. And
and you just had to verbalize your position?
Yeah, so I did everything as a Southern lawyer. And now if you go to Tournament of Nerds, I don't know if I can take credit for this, but now if you go to Tournament of Nerds, people dress up and do characters that aren't associated with necessarily the thing that they're debating. Like there were other people in the tournament who were like wearing Wonder Woman costume or Superman costume or whatever, but I was the first person to go and dress completely unrelated to whatever I was talking about and do a character doing it. So that got me. There was a monthly show at the Meltdown that Jonah hosted and Blaine Kapach hosted. They alternated hosts. And then I came into that, and then I started hosting that show when Jonah stopped hosting it. And then that show ended, and then the weekly show started after that. And then Jonah was like, do you want to come back and be a part of this? And I was like, sure. I have nothing else to do Wednesday nights for six fucking years.
Sure, because I got nothing else.
I got 6 years of Wednesday nights, you jerk. So I started doing that. And then I think we all approached... There was a certain energy and vibe in LA comedy at the time, specifically maybe the alt scene, which is kind of a dumb blanket term, but like the idea that it's a venue that isn't a comedy club. And that I think a lot of the venues sometimes had like this idea of being too cool for school or being elitist, and that Jonah comes from being a punk rock kid and a nerd, and I come from being very shy and being picked on, and Kumail comes from being a guy who came to America, not, you know, from Pakistan, and Emily is a goth Cure fan, and I think we all approached the show with a very populist sense and wanting to make a show that no one, you know, that show's not like a nerd show. That show's not like a geek show. That show's not a cool kid show. It's a warm place. And the best thing is that there are people who are very good comics now who are doing really great stuff who've come up and said that The Meltdown was the first show that they went to that made them feel like being a part of comedy was something they could do. So that, I think that's...
Now, is there a show, is it tonight's
there's,
last?
There's a show, there's three more shows
three
left.
Three more shows?
So,
okay. I think tonight, I want to come to the last one.
Yeah, you should. I think it's going to be a really great show. And, you know, hopefully that is the thing that we gave everybody, is that, like, you can try to do really great stuff without having to be elitist, you know, without having to exclude anybody.
Isolate. Yeah.
There's no greatness doesn't have to be isolationist, you know, like the Velvet Underground played in a warehouse. So, you know, like you can be, accepting of everyone. And, you know, if you come, like we always do high fives at the beginning, and how that started was I hated asking people to show me their stamps because I didn't want to be a bouncer. So I told the person to do the stamps to the inside of their wrist. And so then if I ask them to high five, I see that they have stamps. I never have to tell them. So they never feel like they're being carded. They never feel that they're being
security checked. That's a great little switch, dude. That's brilliant. I mean, it's the littlest thing to go, hey, we're going to do something different. I'm actually going to do something kind of, you know, business-wise, but you won't feel that.
Yeah.
And then you'll actually enjoy it, and it'll become a thing.
Yeah, you never...
Dude, that's brilliant.
Yeah,
dude.
So that...
Love that.
That's the thing, and also, I'm a pretty big guy. I look like a jock, and I act like an idiot. And so I think if you're shy and you're insecure, a lot of times that's the...
Disarming.
Yeah, it lets them know that, like, no one's going to pick on you for laughing.
It's safe here.
So, yeah. So, I think that hopefully that's a little bit that I did there. And it's an amazing show. And I just hope that we've gotten a lot of people who are, like, they're sad or they're upset that it's ending. And just there'll be another show that'll come along. And hopefully, and if you're really bummed about it ending, like, start a show. We started with a guitar amp on a chair.
There you go.
We used to have to tell the employees to stop sorting stock. Before, when it was a monthly show, we'd be like, hey, guys, can you stop working? We have an audience here, so.
Exactly. Well, what we're, you know, is people want things just perfect before they start. Like, I want this plan written out all the way to success, and then I'm going to start. Right. And I don't know if you know Aaron Blairt.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he's a client. And he, him and I started a ProU Power Minute, little animated thing. And he goes, well, let's just start it. We'll figure out as we went. And he knew nothing about animation. The first one he did, I was like, dude, you know, I love it. And people are like, he just started? He knows so much. But both him and I were talking, and the second one just went out, and I watched it like 10 times. And I'm like, you know, I want to add this beginning. He's like, okay, we'll talk. So we met. And as I'm driving there, I was like, what's... And I just thought about it. So I got there. I go, Aaron, I go, is there music on the second one? He's like, totally forgot. I go, I watched it 10 times, you know, because he took my podcast little intro music, and he's like, I'll add it to the, you know, beginning of the first one. I go, oh, cool. Totally forgot the second one. So we're talking about this, and it's exactly what I said to him. I go, I love the fact that you and I are the same way. Let's start. My one arm moves. My left arm doesn't move yet. And he put lines for the fingers. You know, it's just wonky little. Because the first hand he had, I go, dude, did I hit some shrapnel? I mean, what's the deal with my right arm? And that we're just doing it. And we're like, well, we'll get better. We'll figure it out. Yeah. He's like the second one. He learned a lot versus that kind of thing. And I love the fact that you guys started like that. Because you are telling people, number one, if you're sad about something ending because you liked it, start your own. You know what? And that's a great challenge out there, because and the last thing I want to say about that is I would much rather have people sad that I was ending something than not caring or glad that I was ending something. I mean, that's the greatest compliment there is, people being affected by its end.
Yeah. What I've said to people is, like, we had the conversation of should we, before we had to have the conversation of we have to.
Bravo.
And that's,
bravo.
And that's a good thing.
Because I told Jonah this from the get-go. He wants good product.
Yeah, he is.
And if he is not in a good place, then it's not going to be good product. And he's like, well, why would I put out bad product? And it makes sense. So that's the thing when you start going, okay. And I think it's like a relationship. If you love your significant other, you should be a 4 out of 10 or an 8 out of 10. And I don't mean physically. And it's the same thing. So you're an artist and you're up in front of an audience who's loyal, who's been around for 6 years, and you go, okay, do I just keep feeding you less and less value because I feel obligated to keep serving you? Or do I go, you know what, as soon as the value's going to drop, I'm going to bow out because I love you and respect you that much. And I think that's completely what's happening.
Yeah, and I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to seeing who sort of comes along and takes Wednesday night over. Because Wednesday night,
exactly, dude. That's the beautiful thing is there's a lot of people who look at a closed door forever, and then there's the other group of people who go, okay, that door closed, and they turn around knowing that another door is going to open, and of course that's going to happen. And I told Jonah, well, I tell people this that I know, but I told Jonah this. I said, you have yet to think of that idea that's going to be that next big thing. It's not even in your head. But what has to happen is you got to clear some space.
Yeah.
So, you know, Hardwick went from 3 podcasts down to 1. Jonas says, I'm not going to do, you know, Meltdown anymore. It's like, what are they doing? Well, you know, they're progressing, but what they truly are doing is they're now opening up space for that next new
evolution
thing.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. Actually, maybe 2, and then we can close. The dichotomy I have found, I'm going to ask you this question based on. Do you look at yourself, if you had to, would you call yourself a nerd or a jock?
I don't know. I guess I would say a nerd more than a jock, but only because everything I approach is still from a sort of analytical,
I would say that
direction,
too.
You know?
I think it was a kind of a nerd guy that had a reason to be athletic, and that's a pretty impressive thing, though. Like I said, there's a lot of nerds going, well, I'm going to join some sports because I want some friends.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think there's a busload of those nerds, because to me, what was different for me was I think everything about me, like maybe mentally, emotionally, was nerdy.
Yeah.
But I happened to be fast, and I happened to be able to fight. And so there was this weird thing, because then when I got here and I started training, all of a sudden, the guy who looked like a jock was training nerds.
Yeah.
And it was such a funny thing, because this is, you know, a long time ago. But I was in the, you know, kind of computer, so I remember having this one client who could kind of help me, and I was like, what's this? You know, so Mike Furman came along, and I never charged him. We traded for Photoshop. So he taught me Photoshop. So then all of a sudden I was this, and I was asking, you know, Hardwick, because like, when am I officially a nerd? Because I'm doing this, right? Because I have always loved the techie kind of knowledge that nerds had. But the other thing that I found was that nerds were nice, and they were kind, and I think a lot of them were kind of twisted, because when you look at me, and I've been judged how I've looked my whole life, that's a whole other story. And then they found out that I wasn't.
Yeah.
That they're like, hey, that guy that looks like he would be there, he likes me. He hugged me. He did whatever. And that's what I'm saying, is this blossomed this whole time. But listening to your story, you're like, did Dungeon Dragon. But then I was in Nebraska playing football. I'm like, wait a minute. You were like both spectrums. And I'm like, that's it. I have never heard of that.
I also saw the Shaka Zulu special when I was a kid. And for whatever reason, it's this miniseries. It's really great. But like Shaka Zulu, the thing that he did was he united the armies of the tribes. He was kind of like Genghis Khan of Africa, and like united all these tribes to fight against the British invasion. And And I remember there's a line about like something about, you know, like just become friends with your enemies and they won't fight you anymore or something like that. Something to that extent.
You just took those things and went with them.
So I was just like, well, I'll just join the football team and then the football team will stop beating me up.
Brilliant. Like three times in your life has totally took this pivotal change based on one line spoken from someone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like Henry Rollins, Shaka Zulu.
And literally on a dime almost, you're like, okay, I'm going to go this way now with my life.
Yeah,
that's insane.
It just made more sense to be like, well, I'll be on the football team, or if I'm not on the football team, it's harder for them to beat me up or whatever.
No, I get, like I said, but that's, see, to me, I'm going, that's a courageous kid that goes, okay, I'm weak, I'm skinny, I'm fragile, I'm insecure, but I'm going to go join the football team and hoping that they.
Well, I know
whatever that is, dude. I'm just saying that's impressive because the 99% of the people that thought exactly what you did were like. No, that's exactly why I'm not going to join.
Well, I knew where the hits were coming from then, see? It's like they beat me up on the field instead of after, you know? So that was
isn't that just crazy what you just said? The only thing you didn't like about football is you didn't know where the hits were coming from. But the reason you joined football was because I'm going to know.
I wasn't scared walking home
that's
anymore.
That's such a great, you came with some great, like, yeah, you turned out okay. I think I'm going to actually this up.
Thank you.
Odds of me just recording it and then deleting it, but it looks like it's it's looking up here at the end.
Yeah, I'm glad this just wasn't an intervention of some sort.
Question for you. When did you go to therapy? When did that happen?
I started therapy, I don't go anymore because I moved away from my therapist.
So logistics is what's caused you?
Yeah, and I kind of, we got to the end. Like I went to therapy and I said, I have these things that I want to work on.
And you worked on them.
And we worked on them. And
bravo.
And he said, you don't need to come anymore. I wasn't on antidepressants anymore. I wasn't upset with my career anymore. I was able to be in a relationship. I was able to communicate.
Beautiful.
And I was able to find sort of.
I love that you went to a therapist and you had like a specific, like, these are the things.
Yeah.
And then you worked, instead of going, I'm just not happy and I'm going to, you know, what's his name?
Yeah.
Woody Allen.
Yeah.
He's gone to a therapist every day of his life for, what is it, 50 years or some crazy thing?
I think it's important when you're asking someone to help you, whether it's personal training, whether it's therapy, that they're giving you the skills to where if they disappeared, you'd still be able to do the thing that you need to be done. You know, it's like if...
I think anybody, teacher, therapist, trainer, whatever, they've got to be challenging you and making you grow.
Yeah.
If you're just going somewhere to bitch or vent...
I miss that part of therapy, but that's really the only part I miss is like the part of like, well, I had someone to yell at for a little while who had to listen to me, but that's why I do stand up too. So it works out.
Yeah. Fine. You just find that vent.
But yeah, I went and it was a great, it was hard and I had a very good therapist. So anyone who, anyone who thinks about it, like go, you can, there's a website, like find a therapist website. Therapists work on sliding scales, so if you can't afford more than $25 a week, a lot of them will take $25 a week.
Good point, Ed. I've never brought that up, and I was aware of that. Great job. Love that.
There are a lot of organizations that provide free therapy, especially for LGBTQ people who have a high suicide rate. Go to any LGBTQ...
Another great point, Ed.
The hardest thing I ever did was pick up the phone and tell and tell somebody at my health insurance that I needed to see a therapist. I was shaking. And I was like, I think I need to see a therapist.
I was just going
to
ask you if it was hard for you to...
It was hard. And
wow.
I called. They said, here, go to this website, pick one out. You get, I think I got 20 sessions a year is how many the insurance company covered. Some insurance, and if you're in California, you should have insurance. So see what your insurance company will cover. Call therapists, make appointments for your first meeting, go in there and treat it like an interview for them. You're hiring them. They're working for you. If you find a therapist, I hear people who are like, oh, my therapist is this. My therapist is too new agey. My therapist is too Freudian. Like, find a different therapist. Find one that works with you. I got very lucky in that I met my therapist. He was a Jewish guy from New York. A lot of my family is from Boston and New York. My family grew up in Park Slope.
When so there was something like relatable to him.
Yeah. And then he worked for the Catholic Diocese in Philadelphia. He was their therapist. And then he was the therapist. Now he's or he was the therapist for the LAPD dealing with people after shooting. So my thought was, he understands Catholicism. He understands the East Coast, where my family's from. So understand my parents and that background. And he also has...
Can help you fix a parking ticket.
Picking parking ticket. Well, I was also like, there's no way that my story is ever going to be the worst story that he has to hear in a day. Like,
bravo.
Know. Oh. Shh.
That's right. That's just the delivery.
Okay. So like, so I knew that he, that was all, like, he was everything that I was looking for. And we had a really great relationship. He would say things to me like, I'll only call you an asshole once a session. He was older. He's like, I'll only call you an asshole once a session, but you're being an asshole to your girlfriend. And I was like, okay. And he was, and then he could read me and tell if there were times that I, cause sometimes I shut down, and like there were times where he would just talk. And it, there's, my mom was a single mom for a while in Park Slope, and she's a part of this program in the 70s and 80s where the public schools of New York, you could work for the school and you would be allowed to come in late and leave early so that you could pick, drop your kids off and pick your kids up. Your kids are never unattended. This is a great program. Why it doesn't exist in every major city. It gets you people working in the schools.
Wow. Yeah.
It's so that this is a program. Through our therapy, I found out that he was on the board of directors of that program.
Wow.
So, you know, it was a coincidence, but it's, but the point is that I evaluated him at the beginning and really looked at him and said, are you somebody who has elements that will be able to connect with me and be good for me for therapy? And so if you're, feel like you need a therapist, don't feel like the first person that you meet is the person. Don't feel,
or if you're referred it, that's the one you have to take.
Keep, I mean, shopping. I couldn't go to a therapist that didn't understand Catholicism, because that was unwinding. That was a huge part of my life. So, you know, if I went to a therapist who was Buddhist and never, and grew up in the Buddhist, nothing wrong with Buddhism,
no,
but they would have a hard
time.
They're
not going to see through your eyes.
Right. But someone who's talked to nuns and priests for 10 years as a therapist gets what's going on. So go get help, go find someone, go find a therapist, go engage it, you know, whether everything is about keeping your head on your swivel, you know, being, whether that's emotionally, exercise, career, love life, just
stay
kind
ready.
Of, yeah.
Stay ready. All right. Last question.
Go.
Are you ready?
Yes.
See, that was a good answer to what we just said about being ready, and you said you're ready.
I'm so prepped.
Way to go. What is the, like right now, what is the thing that you are trying to work on the most personally? Like, is there still a challenge, or is it a new one, or is it the old one? Or
I think everything in my life right now is sort of trying to learn how to deal with being an adult diagnosed dyslexic. And so I was late to this because I didn't put it in my iCal, which is something that dyslexics have memory issues and have time management problems. So I use iCal for everything. So whether it's like, I'm going to meet you for drinks, or I'm going to do an open mic, I put it in the calendar to remind myself. And so it's, that's the constant challenge, and that accepting that not being able to read as fast as everybody, or not being able to write, you know, as well as every, or as good as every, as well as everyone, doesn't mean that I should not do those things. That you can improve yourself from where you are. So even though you may not be, it's easy to think about it in physical terms, in a way, like, it's easy for me to say, well, you can't run a marathon yet, and you may never run a marathon, but you can definitely get to where you run farther than and faster than you run now. And people get that.
Yep.
But that's in everything in your life. And for me, like, it's learning how there's not a lot of, you know, I say it in my stand-up. I said, when I found out I was dyslexic, I went to the one place everyone goes, the internet, and to look up dyslexia and see if there's any help. And if you want to know something that's very ineffective. It's a message board run by and for dyslexic people. It's really not great. And
probably for good humor, though.
It's really, yeah, I mean, it's actually really tragic, but it's really, yeah, you know, there's not a lot out there for people who didn't, if you weren't diagnosed in grade school or high school, there's not a lot out there for you. But, you know, that's, I think that's the thing. It's like, if you wanted to, my mom always is like, I wish I wanted to play violin. And I'm like, well, play, you're not dead. Go buy a violin. They're not even that expensive.
There's a story I read a long time ago called the daffodil principle. And this woman is somewhere in California. And it's like this big valley kind of thing. But if you walk up just around her house, you get to a point, you look and you see this valley full of yellow daffodils. And then as you're walking towards it, there's a sign. And it's like the most commonly asked questions. Who planted these? I did. How did you do it? One at a time. How many? Like 50,000 bulbs or whatever it was. And she was like 50. And she's like, "Got." I don't know what the story was. Like, I got divorced. I had nothing to do. So I thought, let me go plant. And so she just, without any vision of where she was headed, and she had created over time, without any purpose, intention, mindset, something that was now attracting people. And it was a story about this mother, this woman bringing her mother to this and talking about it in the car. And then they get there and this woman's like, oh, I looked and was like, and trying to go, yeah, you know, you just got to start wherever you are.
So, yeah, I guess my answer is to, the thing I'm trying to do is improve the things I'm not good at that I want to improve at. Without Bravo. Fear of failing.
Well, I've always said that, you know, you want to either keep learning and growing and evolving or you don't. And I don't understand. I couldn't. Like, the better I get, the more I want to, you know, I want to get better. Oh, I'm feeling better. I want to feel better. And that's that thing that just kind of keeps us moving forward. Ed, thank you so much for your time
and energy. Thank you for having me.
And sharing. And Zen was thrilled.
Zen, you're probably going to have to edit all the talking Zen did.
He was a little noisy today. He did bark once. And that's only he'll be sleeping just like that. He'll hear something. He goes, oh, and then he closes his eyes again. That's the only time he'll bark. Yeah, we're talking about you. His eyes just opened. Hello, buddy. All right, Ed, thank you so much. Remember, you are worth it.
Yes.
Hello, and welcome to your Pro-You moment. I'm very glad you're here. Proud of you that you're here. So let us begin. If you can sit on the floor with your legs crossed, that would be fantastic. If not, it's okay. You can sit on the floor, but you need to sit up against the chair or couch, or sit in the chair or couch, that's fine. Again, I'm just thankful you're here. You deciding a few minutes of your day you are worth. And then let's become aware of our breath. Let's just slow down that breath a little bit. Have that inhale go through the nose, exhale out the mouth. Try to lengthen it. Try to be aware of it. Try to keep track of it. That's connecting your mind and body. It's making you present in the here and now. It's a good place to be. Trust me. So let's become aware of our body, navel into our spine. Shoulders above our hips, neutral neck, eyes closed, and just breathing, just being. For 180 seconds, you'll do your best to stay focused And if you lose focus, just bring it back to your breath, to this moment, to the now. I will let you know when time is up. Begin now. If you can stay there physically, that'd be fantastic. If you have to move or stretch, that's cool. But let's just try to stay there, eyes closed, breathing. Just being aware for a moment longer. I want you to get comfortable being uncomfortable. If this is your first time and you felt silly or weird because it was unfamiliar, yay. If you're not real happy where you are, uncomfortable is a good path to follow. It means you're doing things you haven't done before. What was beautiful about Ed was when he realized something was missing, he instinctively kind of was like, I'm going to try to fill that space. I'm going to try to bridge that gap. And all of it was uncomfortable for him. All of it was. But if you're not willing to at least seek help, ask for help, talk to someone. Another great quote I love, argue for your limitations, and sure enough, they're yours. If my life is so bad, I'm not going to do anything about it. There you go. There's neither good nor bad. Only thinking makes it so. So whatever your cards were today, or what you were born with, or what you're going through, just play them. Just play them the best you can. Don't limit your potential by your lack of vision or belief in yourself because you're funky. I've been funky a lot. I'm better. I'm way better now. Deem yourself worthy. Search for answers. Search for a better you. Learn, grow, evolve. Peace and God bless.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.